Chapter 15. At Hotel Kangerlussuaq, 1,300 miles away, Clay Hughes was finishing a breakfast of bacon, eggs, hash browns, and toast, washed down with a pot of steaming coffee. Michael Nielsen approached his table.
"You ready to go?" Hughes asked, standing up.
"The weather has not improved much," Nielsen said, "but I'm willing to try if you want. What's your verdict?"
"We go," Hughes said.
"If I were you," Nielsen said, "I'd have the hotel pack some food for the trip. If we go down out there, it'll be some time before help can arrive."
"I'll order a platter of sandwiches and a couple thermoses of coffee," Hughes said. "Anything else you can think of we might need?"
"Just some luck," Nielsen said, glancing outside.
"I'll get the food and meet you at the helicopter."
"I'll be ready," Nielsen said, walking away. 15 minutes later, the EC-130B-4 lifted from the snow-packed runway and started flying east. A slight tinge of yellow infused the clouds as the scant sunlight tried to penetrate the gloom. Mostly, it was dark and dreary, like an omen carried on an evil wind. The hours passed as the Eurocopter flew high above the snowy terrain. The Thiokol stopped and Cabrillo stared at the map. He estimated that he was within an hour of reaching the cave on Mount Forel. Once he had started away from the glacier, he noticed his satellite telephone was receiving signals again. He hit the speed dial and called the Oregon.
"We've been trying to reach you," Hanley said as soon as he answered. "The Emir was kidnapped last night."
"Kidnapped?" Cabrillo said quickly. "I thought we were on top of that situation."
"They grabbed our guy," Hanley said, "and we have had no communication with either party since."
"Do you have any idea where they've taken him?"
"We're working on it."
"You get our man back," Cabrillo said.
"Will do."
"I'm almost at the site," Cabrillo said. "I'll wrap this up and get out of here. Meanwhile, you locate me some faster mode of transportation home."
"Yes, sir,"
Hanley said. Cabrillo disconnected and tossed the telephone on the passenger seat. At the same time Cabrillo started up Mount Forel, an attendant at Reykjavik International Airport was sweeping snow from the bottom of a ramp leading up to a privately owned 737. Auxiliary power units were supplying the plane with heat and electricity from both sides. The inside of the jet was lit up like a billboard, and it spilled out of the windows into the dim light outside. Peering from the cockpit window, the pilot watched as a black limousine wheeled onto the runway and pulled up alongside the ramp. He watched as four people filed out from the rear. Two of them quickly climbed the steps as the other two scanned the airport grounds to see if anyone was watching. Finding it clear, they quickly climbed up the ramp and closed the door to the jet. The attendant unhooked the APUs, then backed the ramp away and stood quietly while the pilot started the engines. After calling the tower for clearance, he taxied out to the runway and lined up for takeoff. With the refueling stop in Spain, they'd reach their destination 14 hours from now. As soon as the 737 left the runway, the attendant bent down and spoke into a microphone clipped onto his parka near the hood. "They're away," was all he said.
"Acknowledged,"
Hanley answered. Since his conversation with Hanley, Cabrillo had been steering the Thiokol uphill for nearly an hour. He stopped, fastened his parka tight, and climbed out. Adjusting the lights so he could scan the mountain, he walked around to the front to knock ice from the grill. He was just about ready to climb back inside when he heard a thumping sound in the distance. Reaching into the cab, he twisted the key and shut the Thiokol's engine off. Then he listened again. The noise floated on the wind, ebbing and flowing like the tide. Finally, Cabrillo identified the sound, and he climbed back inside the snowcat and reached for the telephone. "Max," he said quickly, "I hear a helicopter approaching. Did you send someone out?"
"No, boss,"
Hanley said.
"We're still working on that."
"Can you find out what's going on?"
"I'll try to link onto a DOD satellite and figure out who it is, but it might take 15 to 20 minutes.
"I'd like to know who's crashing my party," Cabrillo said.
"One thing we found out is that there's an unmanned U.S. Air Force radar site nearby,"
Hanley said.
"Maybe the antennas are still being used and the Air Force is flying someone there for repairs or whatever."
"You find out for me," Cabrillo said as he twisted the key and started the engine. "I think I'm almost at the cave."
"Will do,"
Hanley said. Using a sled to pack down the snow and a dozen packets of Kool-Aid, Ackerman had managed to create a nice landing spot marked with an X on a small mesa only 70 yards from the lower opening of the cave. He stared at the spot with pride. The helicopter should be able to land without the rotor blade striking the mountain. It was precarious, but it was the best that he could do on the side of a mountain. He retreated back into the mouth of the cave and waited as the helicopter approached the landing pad, then hovered and sat down. The rotor blade slowed, then stopped, and a man climbed from the passenger side. Cabrillo heard the helicopter land through his open window, but through the snow and darkness he'd not been able to see it touch down. He was close. He could sense that. He attached nylon gaiters around his down-filled pants and removed a pair of snowshoes from the rear bed. Sliding his boots into the bindings, he fastened them tight. Then he reached in back and removed the cardboard box holding the decoy that Nixon had made. Now all he had to do was slip into the cave undetected and make the switch.
"The boss sent me," Hughes said to Ackerman after climbing up the hill to the mouth of the cave, "to check out your find."
Ackerman smiled proudly. "She's a peach," he said, "possibly the most important archaeological find of this century."
"So I hear," Hughes said, edging farther into the cave. "And he sent me to make sure you get what you deserve."
Ackerman grabbed an already lit lantern and started to lead Hughes down the passage.
"So you're in public relations?"
"That and other duties,"
Hughes said, stopping at the opening in the ceiling. A few days ago, Ackerman had brought a wooden ladder from inside the upper cave and dropped it down the hole. It made going between the two shafts a lot easier.
"We'll climb up and I'll give you the grand tour," Ackerman said.
The two men climbed the ladder into the upper cave. Hughes played along as Ackerman rattled off what he had found. But truly, there was only one thing he'd come for. And as soon as he had that, he was leaving. Cabrillo traipsed around the side of the mountain until he came upon a spot of melted snow. Bending over, he could see that there was a small opening in the mountainside, marked by rocks laying in the snow, as if they'd been tossed out from inside the mountain. Warm air from inside the mountain was filtering out, melting the snow around the opening. Clearing away enough of the debris so that he could climb inside, he slid through the opening into the upper cave, then dragged the cardboard box inside. Once he was through the opening, he found he could stand. He walked down the shaft to see where it went. Even with a heart of stone, Hughes was finding the cave and its inner sanctum impressive. Ackerman was standing alongside the meteorite on its altar with his arm outstretched like a prize lady on a game show.
"Beautiful, isn't it?" Ackerman gushed.
Hughes nodded, then removed a portable Geiger counter from his pocket. Flicking it on, he scanned the meteorite. The readings were off the scale. A couple of hours of exposure and he'd quickly start to suffer from radiation poisoning. He realized he'd need to shield it carefully for the trip back to Kangerlussuaq.
"You spent much time close to this?"
Hughes asked Ackerman.
"I've examined it from every angle,"
Ackerman told him.
"Have you been feeling poorly? Noticed any physical changes in yourself lately?"
"I've been having nosebleeds," Ackerman said. "I figured it was just the dry air."
"I think you have radiation sickness," Hughes said. "I'm going to need to go back to the helicopter and get something to shield this."
Cabrillo hurried down the shaft toward the sound of the voices. Hiding behind a rock, he listened to the two men.
"I'm going to need to go back to the helicopter and get something to shield this," one said.
He listened as the two men walked off and the cavern grew dark. He waited to see what would happen next.
"Wait here,"
Hughes said when they reached the mouth of the lower cave. Ackerman watched as Hughes walked down the hill, approached the helicopter, and opened the rear door.
"I'll be back in a few minutes," he said to Nielsen as he removed a box from the rear. "Then we can go."
"Sounds good,"
Nielsen said, staring out at the weather. Hughes started back up the hill with the box. When he entered the cave, he looked at Ackerman.
I brought something that will ease your suffering, he said. I'll give it to you in a few minutes.
Cabrillo waited a minute until he was sure he was alone, then reached into his pocket and removed a plastic bag and ripped off the top. Removing the chemical light bar inside, he bent it in half like he was trying to break a breadstick, and the tube started glowing green. Using the light to illuminate his way, he started to walk toward the meteorite. He was just approaching the altar when he heard a shot ring out. Quickly reaching into his pocket, he removed a foil packet, tore off the top with his teeth, and sprinkled the contents onto the meteorite. Then, with the sounds of footsteps quickly approaching, he slid off to the side behind some rocks and placed the green light in his pocket. A tall man, carrying a lantern, walked over to the altar, scooped up the meteorite, and placed it in a box. Cabrillo had left the rifle in the thiokol, so there was little he could do right now. Cabrillo would need to intercept the meteorite farther down into the cave. Gripping the metal hoop from the lantern in his mouth, the man carried the box out. Cabrillo waited until the light from the lantern petered out, then slowly walked down the cave with his chemical light held in front. He figured the men would be examining the meteorite somewhere else, and when he found them, he'd make his move. Then he bumped into the ladder and nearly fell down the hole. Listening carefully to see if they'd heard the noise, Cabrillo waited, and when nothing happened, he climbed down the ladder. At the bottom, he stepped on Ackerman's body.